Hello and welcome back to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and today I'm joined by our Deputy Editor, Matt Matem.
Hello.
And our Editor-at-Large, Jamie Graham.
Hello.
Hello. We've got that was a bit of a creepy laugh and a sort
that
of...
That was.
What have you been up to, Jamie?
I've just been in my house, not doing anything apart from watching movies and working and going slowly insane and melting in the heat wave.
Yeah, it's far too hot. Okay, so let's crack on then, shall we? This week, we're going to be rating Baby Teeth, Pinocchio, Spree and Sputnik. But first, shall we answer a reader's question? What film character are you most like? Jamie, I think we probably know who you're most like, don't we?
This is stumping me, so you tell me and then I'll try and do it, but...
That laughing furball in Dark Crystal.
Fizzgig.
Yeah, Fizzgig.
I didn't even think of that, but yeah, I've got all the hair and I do, when I laugh, I rock my head back and shake all over, so...
Yeah, and most of your face is covered in hair, so probably that.
I was going to say for Jamie, I was actually going to say the dude from The Big Lebowski.
Just thanks, mate.
The long hair, the beard, the shorts, anytime, you know.
Yeah.
I was completely
laid back about everything.
I was really stumped by this question, so I actually WhatsApped my mates, and one of them came back with Tarzan. I mean, I was hoping he was referring to the sculpted body, but of course he was just referring to the long hair and just being a basic Neanderthal man. And then another one, because we all watched, when we were kids, we watched Stand By Me all the time, as I've banged on about endlessly.
Yes.
And in my head, I've always been Chris. I've been the slightly sort of tough but tender, cool leader, all of that. That's completely in my head. One of
and
my
they
mates
said Teddy.
They came back and said Vern, that I'm a complete buffoon and the butt of every joke. So that was fine. Yeah,
I was going to say you were Gordy as well.
Oh, thanks, mate. Yeah. Sensitive, wanted to be a writer, there's a bit of that there, but
yeah.
Anyway, enough about me. What about you two?
I think also we've got to mention that Matt Matem does have a passing resemblance to Henry Cavill,
which
you never see the two of them in the same room. But who do you think, Matt?
Well, I wish I could take credit for that, so I'll say that as a very huge compliment, but not one that I see. I would like to say Jesse from the Before trilogy, just because being sort of like a writer, a hopeless romantic, etc., someone who just likes to navel gaze a lot and just sort of chat about meaningless things. But then maybe this is also a shameful one, especially in this day and age, but some of the early Woody Allen protagonists, Albie Singer, you know, like just that neuroses, that worrying about everything, that constantly thinking you've got a terminal illness. Like, sadly, I just relate all too much to things like that. So I'd quite possibly be one of those characters.
Yeah, I could see you sort of chasing a lobster around a holiday home and being completely inept. Yeah.
Do you know who I'd say for you, Matt Matem? Straight out, I'm going to surprise you here. You think I'm going to be derogatory, but I would say Captain America.
Goodness.
I would, because you're sincere, you're pure of heart, focused. Yeah, Captain America, I'm going for
it. I'll take it.
Not bad at all. We should also mention that Jack Shepherd, who is often on this podcast, is a dead ringer for Joe Keery from Stranger Things, who we'll be talking about later in the pod, but he is an absolute dead ringer for him.
What about you, Jane? You can't escape this.
No, so, I mean... When I was little, I really wanted to be Lois Lane and I hoped I would grow up to be her. But I think actually the person that most people say when they watch the film and she reminds them of me is actually the Kristen Wiig character in Bridesmaids. It does suggest that I get drunk and leery on planes, possibly. I do ridiculous things and that I take my friends out to places and give them food poisoning and would never accept that I have food poisoning. Would rather eat a sugared almond in a wedding dress shop. So I'm okay with that. Yeah. So yeah, I'm going to go for her.
I've seen you drunk and leery in my time, but...
Hopefully never grounded a plane.
Never grounded a plane. I have seen you throw a sausage out a window once, but...
And let's draw a veil over that.
Okay.
Shall we get our teeth into the first film then that we're going to see? And let's this one.
I'll do anything. Can he please stay?
He threatened me with a meat prong.
You threatened my wife with a meat prong?
I don't want to hurt you.
So don't.
Moses!
Wait, Henry!
Miller should have the world at her feet right now.
I have no idea what you're feeling.
I can't feel anything because I can't breathe because you take up all the air.
This
think something in you has changed.
When I met you, it was like you weren't scared of anything.
I don't think the world would be this big or weird if we become obsessed with functionality.
She's gonna be okay.
Oh, and that'll do it.
This is the worst possible parenting I can imagine.
That is baby teeth. Matt, what is this about? Who has baby teeth?
This comes from director Shannon Murphy, who's previously best known for her TV work like Killing Eve season 3. And this is actually her feature debut. And it's adapted by Rita Kalnaget from her own play, which I haven't seen. But the film is about Miller, who's a terminally ill teenager. But before you go thinking that it might be something really sentimental, like Fault in Our Stars or Now is Good, it's very, very different to that kind of thing. I say the film's about Miller as well, who's played by Eliza Scanlon, who was Beth in the recent Little Women. But it's really kind of about her parents as well, as much as it's about her. And they're played by Essie Davis and Ben Mendelsohn. And it's also about this drug dealer called Moses, who this seemingly unstable boyfriend for Miller. Like, I'm not sure we ever find out how old she is, but you presume she's about 15, 16.
I think she's 16.
She is mentioned as considerably younger than him, and he's 23.
They mention he's 23, don't they? But I didn't notice her age mentioned. So yeah, this 23-year-old kind of local, small-scale drug dealer called Moses, and he ends up sort of moving in with the family, and he kind of ends up being this agent that draws her out a bit for her final months because she's suffering from this terminal illness. You gather that it's cancer based on the sort of chemotherapy and what happens to her. But again, it's never really in that much detail. It's very much in the background. You don't spend time in the hospital rooms. You don't see loads of charts and things like that. It's very much about how it affects the family home, really.
So did you like it more than The Fault in Our Stars, etc., etc., and all those other sort of teen cancer terminal illness movies?
Well, it's probably more to my taste than those films, I would say. It was one of those films, I'm very, very interested to hear what you guys think, because it debuted at the Venice Film Festival last year to raves.
Yeah.
So that set my expectations maybe a bit too high. And I found it really, really interesting and fascinating to watch. I thought the acting from that central quartet was really top drawer. Essie Davis is always great. I thought this was Ben Mendelsohn's best role for ages as well. I did feel moved by the end, but it was also that category of film that I admired rather than like really enjoyed, I felt. But I'm intrigued to know what you guys think.
I'm kind of with Matt in that, like Matt said, it premiered at Venice and it got rave reviews and everyone seems to adore it. And I think it's good and nothing special. It stuck in my throat a little bit, but on the one hand, it's very naturalistic, but it's all sort of natural lighting and handheld camera and naturalistic acting. But on the other hand, it's quite sort of arch and stylized in certain ways. Like, there's all these chapter headings. Every sort of 5 minutes, there's a new chapter heading, like Nausea or Romance Part 1 or Romance Part 2. And I sort of felt that wasn't necessary and it kind of clashed with it a little bit. It never really kind of sank into my heart. I never really felt it until the last 10 minutes, which then it did sneak up on me. And I'll admit, I did find the last 10 minutes quite moving. But I kind of was watching it thinking, I've seen this kind of thing before. It's one of those Australian films like Muriel's Wedding and Celia and Sweetie, where it's kind of about a young female kind of marching to the beat of her own drum. And I didn't think it was as good as any of those films I've mentioned. Sweetie particularly, this reminded me of early Jane Campion, that it's got that kind of ruggedness and it's those sort of jagged edges, but at the same time it's quite lyrical. But I think early Jane Campion films like Sweetie and Angel at My Table are far superior to this.
Yeah, I have to agree too. I
was expecting you guys to love it as well. That's why I was intrigued.
I really loved
the weirdo. Just
I love the feel of it and the music and the sort of mood of it. And it's very sort of intoxicating and to be in her world. But I didn't actually find that I understood her motivation, really. And I found myself actually being more interested in the parents. As you said, Essie Davis and Ben Mendelsohn. I thought their dynamic was really interesting. And the fact that obviously the mother is a drug addict herself. She's popping Xanax to get through this trauma of dealing with a very ill child, but at the same time pointing fingers at this boy saying, you know, you can't have someone like that around because they're into drugs. So that sort of dynamic, I kind of would have enjoyed seeing that more than the sort of watching a girl die, which is essentially the theme of this. And I loved everyone's performances, but it, for me, those little individual things didn't add up to the sum of its parts. It didn't make this amazing film that other people had raved about at Venice. And yeah, maybe it is that expectation. But also I feel like we've watched a lot of films like this in lockdown, really good quality films like this. So maybe had I seen this before when I'd been in the middle of, you know, Marvel films and tent poles all the rest of it, this would have struck a different chord. But when I've been watching in lockdown a lot of films like this that are character studies, that are very intimate, etc., it sort of feels just fine.
Yeah, I kind of agree. I think the performances are great. I mean, all four of them, I thought, were absolutely fantastic. Eliza Scanlon is very talented, as well as seeing her in Little Women, as Matt mentioned earlier. She was in Sharp Objects. I think she's got so much ability, but it never really leapt out for me that I kind of watched it. I thought, yeah, this is okay. I enjoyed it. And then it finished and it was just on to the next movie for this podcast. I don't quite see why everyone's raving about it.
Eliza Scanlon, I actually think, is a great actress and she has that really great presence in this. But I thought there was something a bit blank about her as a character. And I suppose it's that weird thing that we all ultimately like project our own feelings and, you know, bring our own interpretations of films. But it sort of felt to me almost like, I wondered if it was supposed to be kind of like a metaphor of parents learning to accept their children growing older and kind of, you know, growing away from them in that sense. When she has a hair loss through the chemotherapy, she does have a real kind of babyish look to her, like almost she just looks like a giant baby. And then there's this whole baby tooth aspect as well, that she still has a baby tooth. I don't know, it just felt like maybe it was going for some kind of metaphor or something about this kind of parents unable to accept their baby sort of changing, but maybe that was just, again, what I brought to the film.
One of the things I did find interesting about this film is that when you've got a terminally ill teenager, is how do you parent them? Because she wants to go out, she wants to experience life before it's too late, she wants to have this love affair with this guy she's fallen head over heels with. Parents disapprove, but what are you going to do? Because, you know, you're not going to ground your child who may only have months left. I mean, what's the point of sending her to her bedroom for 2 weeks, you know? So they kind of have to accept it. I found that quite an interesting dynamic.
Yeah, but I feel like, would you not have wanted to focus more on the parents and that decision? Because it felt like that decision happened with very little real discussion, that they actually ask this boy to move in with them. And it starts really promisingly with them having this sex scene, which I found really funny. I don't know if you enjoyed it, where the two parents were trying to have a quick in their day and Ben Mendelsohn's trying to have his lunch and eat a sandwich at the same time, and they're sort of just answering the phone and going about their business. And that I sort of found really funny and true to life. I'm not saying what I do just to be clear, I don't enjoy a sandwich during that, but it had this tone that was really funny and felt kind of authentic, and then didn't really seem to sustain that for the rest of the film.
Yeah, I think tonally it is a little bit schizophrenic. Like I said earlier, you've got this handheld camera, and I kind of felt that it was doing too much a lot of the time, and it was trying to be too authentic and jittery. And the best moments for me was when it just slowed down. There's a couple of scenes where it really just holds faces and it stops with all the ostentatious camera movement, and those moments where you just let the actors be and let the drama kind of be organic, they were far more powerful for me.
Okay, so we're not completely sold on this. It's in cinemas from the 14th of August. Would you suggest people go and see this on a big screen? It is beautiful to look at.
Personally, I would say wait. And, you know, for me, I think this is the kind of film that's perfectly good to stream, to watch it on DVD, whatever you want to do these days. But I don't think it would really lose anything from not being seen on the big screen.
Okay, so let's move on then from one style of parenting to another. Let's go with this.
Avevo pensato di fabbricarmi con le mie mani, proprio da me, un burattino di legno. Pinocchio, dai, di qualcosa.
Babbo. This is Pinocchio, which Jamie's seen, but Matt and I haven't seen. I guess it's the story of Pinocchio. What's different about this one, Jamie?
What's different about this one is that it sticks very, very faithfully to the original 1883 novel by Carlo Collodi. It's filmed and based in Italy by an Italian director, Matteo Garrone, who people will know him from Gomorrah and Dogman and Tale of Tales. I mean, the first two of those films, Gomorrah and Dogman.
This is a bit different, isn't it?
Well, it is. Gomorrah and Dogman are very kind of social realist, tough adult dramas. Tale of Tales is a real fantasy and, kind of out there and very imaginative. This kind of falls in between the two in a way that even though it's a story of Pinocchio and you think, oh, okay, it's going to be growing noses and, you know, like the Disney cartoon, it's not. It's very kind of hard scrabble, dirt poor Tuscany. You know, you can really feel the poverty. And Geppetto, the woodcutter, who's played by Roberto Benigni, he really, really wants a son, so he carves this wooden puppet. We all know the story. He carves a wooden puppet, Pinocchio, out of a block of wood. The puppet comes to life, really wants to be a real boy. He doesn't listen to his dad. He's very willful. He's very selfish. He just wants immediate gratification. And he runs off with a puppet circus, kind of puppet troupe in a way. Gets into all manner of trouble. He meets the cat and the fox, who are in this version, they're really kind of dastardly, fiendish characters. They're brilliant, absolutely wonderful. He meets a group of assassins. He goes on all these kind of misadventures. And there's the moral of the story is he has to learn to be a real boy. His wooden heart has to kind of learn to accept others and love others and not just be about himself. He suffers a lot of exploitation during the film. It's very, very dark in places. You know, I mean, the Disney version's pretty dark, but this has a scene from the book where the assassins actually leave Pinocchio hanging from a tree by his neck to die at one point, which I can imagine little kids, like, not that I think they're really going to be watching a subtitled Italian movie, but if they do, if you've got an 8-year-old watching this movie, that's going to be very disturbing. What sets it apart from the Disney version is it's so true to the original book. If you read the original book, it's a series of vignettes. This goes through sort of point by point, beat by beat, almost every single vignette in the original novel is in this version. And it's very different from the Disney one in that way.
But does it still have him getting donkey ears? Because I know Matt Mason has a little bit of a problem with that. Traumatised as a child.
Yeah, I think we all were. I mean, the Disney version is dark. It's very disturbing. And this does have the donkey scene. It also has the scene, which is in the Disney one, with being swallowed by the whale. It's got all of those. But like I said, it's got certain vignettes which aren't in the Disney one. For me, this is the film of the week, that where it is the same as Matteo Garrone's previous films is they always deal with the underclass. And even though this is Pinocchio, it's still, like I said, it's set in this really kind of a dirt poor Tuscany, and you can really feel it, like the characters struggling to get by. And then on top of that, it grasps all these wonderful makeup and prosthetic effects. You've got the snail governess who lives with a fairy with turquoise hair, and she's like a sort of giant Jabba the Hutt snail, and everywhere she goes she leaves this slime trail behind her. You've got a judge. Yeah, it's quite funny actually. It causes all manner of problems. You've got a judge who is a griller, so you've got all these really sort of surreal, bizarre moments in this story, which in some ways is very real at the same time. So it's quite an unusual mix. It's very scary in places, it's very dark in places, it's sentimental in places, but then that's true of the original novel. You know, I think it's a really good adaptation. I really would recommend it.
But as you say, it isn't something that you'll be taking the kids to. Obviously, Italian children will be watching it, but unless you speak Italian as a second language in the UK, this is probably for adults that have grown up with that story and fancy a sort of darker take. Is it sort of Del Toro-esque?
No, I would say it's, I mean, Del Toro does darkness and he blends reality and fantasy, as we all know, but to me this is a bit more grounded in a way than Del Toro's films. It's a bit more sort of social realist than Del Toro's films. But what is interesting is Del Toro, of course, is making Pinocchio for Netflix. He's doing an animated version that he's promised is going to be very dark, so it'd be interesting to compare these two versions.
And also Disney's working on a live action remake of Pinocchio
Robert Zemeckis.
Tom Hanks apparently is Geppetto.
So I mean, this basically is, if you've not seen Pinocchio for a while and you want to get ahead of all of those projects coming out, maybe watch this one to remind yourself of the story and then await the rest that's going to come, as they always do, three in ones.
Exactly. To touch on something you said earlier, Jane, like, I don't think, you know, kids in this country, young kids, are going to be watching this film subtitled. It's going to be too dark. But it has been a massive hit in Italy. It's, massive hit with all the family. I think it will scare children, you know, as a lot of the best dark fairy tale kind of things do. You know, I do recommend it. I'd say if you fancy something, you know, a bit bizarre and a bit dark and a bit scary and a bit truthful to life in some ways, then watch it.
It can't certainly be more weird than the life we're currently living. So there we go.
That's true.
Pinocchio is in cinemas from the 14th of August. Right. Have you guys been in an Uber or a Bolt for a while?
No. Not for a long time.
If people listening haven't, this film may put you off.
I'm Kurt.
Hey guys.
What's up, guys?
We're gonna inject this right on the label.
Does this water have like a taste to it?
Airtight. Well, watertight.
If you're not documenting yourself, you just don't exist.
The mouthfeel on this? Otherworldly.
What we're doing here is important. We're creating a brand.
Okay, so that is Spree, starring Joe Keery, who we discussed earlier, who is our Jack Shepherd lookalike. Matt, what is he up to?
So, Spree is directed by Eugene Kotliarenko, I think if I pronounce that right, who's directed films before, but none I've actually heard of. And he co-writes with Gene McHugh, who's a first-time writer, and it stars Joe Keery, who you've mentioned, who's obviously best known as Steve from Stranger Things. Yes, him with the hair.
Yeah,
and the hair. In this, he plays an aspiring online influencer type called Kurt, and the Spree of the title refers to a rideshare app, like you say, basically an Uber or a Lyft, and he sets to go viral while he's driving his car and with this kind of devious plan. And there's something sort of really sweet and earnest about the character, but then there's also this underlying sinister aspect to him, and it all starts with him giving these punters like bottles of water that have been tampered with, and it sort of goes on from there. And he crosses paths with an up-and-coming comedian called Jesse, who's played by Sashir Zamata, who in real life she's been on SNL and things like that, and in the film she does have this kind of growing social media following, so obviously Kurt wants to get in on that, and it sort of spirals out from there. Really,
I really liked this. Did you?
I liked it. Yeah, I found it like very sort of snappy and entertaining, and sort of unsettling when it needs to be as well. And it's all pretty slick, and it's like 90 minutes. It plays like a found footage movie, or I don't know if there's a name for this like emerging subgenre of kind
of
found footage.
Yeah, the sort of all played out on screen. Yeah.
And this is all basically seen through kind of phone cameras and social media feeds and things like that, including a few quite convincing fake sites, like this fake Spree site, for example. And it's a pretty tight 90 minutes. I felt like perhaps it felt like a bit of a stretch by the end, and like it is a bit one note in its commentary as well. But I actually did think it's kind of effective enough. It's not something I think anyone would kind of regret having sort of fun with for 90 minutes. And even if it is one note, I did find it quite enjoyable in terms of skewering that kind of influencer culture and the, just how they present themselves and their lives on camera. The main thing, I thought Joe Keery was really good. I felt this, that he really carried it and really sort of nailed that character.
It is a difficult sell if you don't manage to get the sort of Kurt character correct. And he really manages to straddle that line of being, as you say, incredibly earnest and sort of naive, but at the same time, completely calculating and psychopathic. You have to sort of like him to go along with this, but also the fact that it is, because he's talking directly to camera all the way through this about this murderous intentions he has, it makes you complicit as an audience as well. So you have to be along for the ride, so to speak. So I think he does a really good job with that. And I just found it delicious to watch. I mean, it's not making groundbreaking sort of commentary on life, but it does have such nice little touches. It's really been well thought out in terms of content, hashtag the lesson, you know, like the fact that the victims are sort of people that we traditionally despise, estate agents, racists, Instagram influencers. Misha Barton plays one, Frankie Grande, the influencer brother of Ariana, plays another, you know, and there's David Arquette playing this ridiculous father. The fact that both he and his father are KKs, you know, he's called Kurt Kundal and his dad's called Chris Kundal, which evokes the KKs of the Kardashians. All of these sort of things really sort of play into this world that we're currently living in. I wonder how it will date in the future. It might be very much a snapshot of our times now, but I thought it was super enjoyable. Maybe I was just in the mood for 90 minutes of silliness.
Yeah, it's a very easy watch, isn't it, in that way. Yeah, it's not at all kind of challenging, but very fun while it lasts.
Whether or not it's something you'd bother going to the cinema to see, though, is another question, because the fact that it is all on sort of tablet and phone screens and everything, maybe it would play into that in-world experience if you did watch it on your tablet or your laptop at home rather than on a big screen. So I'm not sure it's necessarily something you go to the cinema to see, but I would highly recommend it for something that is just a bit of fun.
Everything you said sounds great, Jane. I mean, like I said, I haven't seen it yet, but it does strike me because it sounds like you had fun with this film and it's quite entertaining in a way. Is it not a bit flippant, considering that these things really do happen? Like in America, there's so many mass killings and, you know, all of that, and people putting their live footage up, you know, it sounds really disturbing. I mean, does it make light of that at all?
I think you could come down on this either way. You can say that this is a fair reflection of people like Elliot Rodgers, who did shoot and kill 6 people and injured many more in Santa Barbara. And before he did it, he did a YouTube video entitled Elliot Rodgers Retribution. It's either reflecting the reality or it's something that is, do we want to reflect that reality and do we want to encourage people in this? I mean, is it encouraging? I don't think so. It's very definitely black comedy. But yeah, I suppose you could find it distasteful because obviously, as you say, these things do actually happen. What do you think, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose it doesn't really dig into that side of it too deeply. We sort of see a little bit of it, but I guess just the way the film's positioned as we very much go along for the ride, so to speak, with him the whole time, you kind of don't get a huge amount of the sort of backstory and what led to it. But I didn't feel like it was sort of particularly exploitative. But again, I could see obviously some people will take issue with it, I'm sure.
I mean, I suppose it's a similar argument to the, you know, American Psycho argument, you know, and how you feel about that. Is it dark comedy and sort of satire, or is it something distasteful? And where you sit probably with American Psycho is whether you'd enjoy this film. Would you say that's fair?
Yeah, and I suppose it depends if you've been personally affected by anything like this, you know, obviously it's, you just have a completely
different.
He does
say at the beginning trigger warnings, so yeah, there is that aspect. But I don't know, what do you think, Jamie? You reckon you'd see it?
I'd definitely see it. I mean, you know, I like disturbing films and I like sort of black comedies and all of that anyway, so I definitely want to check it out. It sounds, you know, right up my street. You know, it's how they treat it. I don't think we should avoid showing these things and reflecting real life, even if we put it through an exaggerated lens and kind of find dark comedy in it. It's just getting that tone right, because if you get it wrong, then obviously it can be pretty bad.
True. Okay, well, if you want to see whether you think it's a dark satire or something horrible, it's in cinemas from the 14th of August. So let's move on then to something completely different and something extraterrestrial. Are you ready for liftoff with this?
Надо было мне сразу вам все рассказать.
Бегите. Okay, so that is Sputnik, a Russian film, which is set in 1983 when a cosmonaut crash lands in Kazakhstan and there's something wrong with him. He's brought something back. He's got localized amnesia. He can remember certain things, but basically an entity has returned to Earth with him. And so the Russian government call in a doctor, Tatiana Yurievna, who is a hard-ass sort of psychologist, to assess him and decide how they can help him. She has an Achilles heel herself. She has a back injury and she's a bit of a maverick. She doesn't like to follow rules. So what happens when she goes to this remote facility in Kazakhstan and what lies in wait for her? I really liked this. Jamie, you're a bit of a sci-fi fan as well and you like this sort of thing. Did you like this?
I did like it, especially the first two thirds of it. When he comes back and it's like, what's he brought with him? And there's an air of mystery to it and that kind of discovery. And when you find out, you know, I think the effects are good and it's all a bit grim and grotesque and disturbing. And there was a lot I really, really liked about it. I did feel that in the final sort of third, the final 20 minutes maybe, it kind of didn't quite know where to go. But, you know, once you've had all the revelations, then it became a little bit by the numbers for me, but I would recommend it. I liked it.
Yeah, I thought it was, like you say, within half an hour, you've got body horror that is quite disgusting.
Yeah.
And there are special effects of a certain entity that I thought were really good. I hadn't seen a thing like that before. It was particularly gross and slimy.
Didn't you think it had a little bit, because it's got a bit of a bat in there and a bit of various other creatures, but I found it most disturbing. It had a little bit of Jar Jar Binks in there, I thought.
No, don't say that.
It did. Look again.
It has some ears. No, I didn't. I thought that the thing that we're discussing, it was really well realised, and I really liked the fact that this was led by this woman. It sort of reminded me of Proxima a little bit, with this sort of the idea of this space facility and the sort of inherent sexism with space travel that was going on there, and the fact that this woman comes in and is so clever and so on it. Yeah, as you say, as soon as we've discovered what is going on and the true horror of it, because there's a lot of Soviet stuff as well going on here, and so darker times or not, as the case may be. And so there's a lot of sort of what the government is doing. But then it turns into something else, which is a little bit softer and doesn't sit as well with what's gone before.
The last half hour, it basically becomes a kind of, you know, once you know what the monster is and what's going on, it becomes a kind of hunt the monster film. And, you know, and that's fine as it is, but I didn't think it was particularly great at it. It sort of did the job, but it didn't sort of get my pulse racing like the best ones of these movies do. But like you said, what was best about it was the fact you've got this all-male Soviet sort of, you know, government or official figures, and they're using the woman as much as they're, you know, using everything else, that they're trying to play her to get what they want from her. And then she gradually emerges as she would take no nonsense whatsoever, and she you know, really stands up to him and does her own thing, and she's a great character, you know, really powerful.
There's sort of elements of Ripley about her.
Yeah, definitely.
So that is Sputnik, which is available on all digital platforms from the 14th of August. Right, boys, it's time for another one of Matthew Leyland's fiendish quizzes. Oh. I think that Matt might be a little bit ahead on this, because it
is so much pressure on me now.
Yeah,
it's not fair.
In preparation for Tenet coming out, it's the Quiztopher Nolan quiz. Do you like what
you said? I like that.
Quiztopher Nolan.
Can I just leap in before we start and say how unfair this is? There's been a running joke in the Total Film Office for about 5 years between me and Matt that his favourite working director is Christopher Nolan and mine is Paul Thomas Anderson. And we constantly argue, sort of tongue-in-cheek argue about who's the best, blah, blah, blah. And now he's got Christopher Nolan, which is his specialist subject. So I demand when PTA's next film comes out, we do a PTA one to make it even.
We'll see.
Oh, thank you.
Who wants to go first?
I'm under a lot of pressure now as well.
Yeah, if you don't ace this, Matt, I mean, I don't know what to say.
I'll let Jamie choose who goes first.
I will let you go first, Matt, because yeah, you've got to set the example.
Okay, here we go. Here is the Christopher Nolan quiz. Number one, Matt. How many Ready? Oscar nominations does Christopher Nolan have to his name? Is it A, 5, B, 4, or C, 6?
Tough one. Let me try and think if I can think through those noms. Obviously, a couple of films he shamefully wasn't nominated for, like Interstellar or any of the Dark Knight movies. But I'm going to say, I think it's 5.
Correct. Oh, Jamie is already off. Here we go, Jamie.
Yeah.
In which year was Following his first film released in the UK? 1998, 1999, or 2001?
Well, before you gave me the dates on that, I was going to say it's definitely round about 2000, maybe late 90s, because Memento obviously was his second movie, and I think that was that 2000? So I would go, did it get a proper cinema release? Because it was 60,000.
It did get a cinema release.
Did it? Because it cost £60,000, didn't it? It was a tiny little black and white movie. Quite good, actually. Very good. I would go 98.
Oh, Jamie, it's 1999.
Oh, see, this is so unfair.
Yeah, partying like Prince.
Thing is, I will say as well, it's a tough question because it technically is one of those films that's classified as a 98 film. But I guess it must have done the festival rounds and stuff first and maybe come out in the US first.
I think I should get half a point for that. Okay. My reasoning is correct.
We're going 1-0, Jamie. And
you are so harsh. You're such a harsh judge. Every week we have this.
All right, Matt. Dunkirk is Nolan's highest grossing film in the UK. But what's his second highest grossing? Is it Inception, The Dark Knight, or The Dark Knight Rises?
The tricky thing is, if you'd asked me what is his highest grossing film in the UK, I would have known for sure it was Dunkirk. But second, I'm just going to go on instinct and say Dark Knight Rises, just because I'm pretty sure that's his biggest worldwide. And so I'm just going to go by, you know, the rule of averages that I imagine it being pretty big in the UK.
Correct. Of course it is. Jamie? On yes. Which of these movies does Nolan's brother Jonathan not have a story or script credit? Is it Batman Begins, The Dark Knight Rises, or Interstellar?
This is actually weird because I was going to say I always prefer his films when his brother is involved and has a script writing credit. I think he's great and brings something to him. But I'm now going to totally contradict myself by saying I think it's Batman Begins. And the reason I'm contradicting myself is Batman Begins is actually my favourite Batman movie, more than everyone says Dark Knight. But for me, it's Batman Begins. So I would go Batman Begins.
Correct. Matt, which of these titles does Nolan have? An OBE, an MBE, or a CBE?
I actually don't know this one. I don't even know what they mean. Or Order of the British Empire. No, I've got no idea what the others are. So
PTA's got all three of them.
I just guess OBE.
It's a CBE.
Oh, he's back in it.
Damn it.
So, Jamie.
Yes.
Insomnia.
He's going to be a sir one day, though, isn't he?
He should be a sir one day. Come on.
Needs to win an Oscar first.
Well, yeah. But then it could be Sir Michael and Sir Christopher having their films together. Okay, so Insomnia is a remake of a 1997 film, which was made in which country? Norway, Denmark, or Iceland?
I know this one without a doubt. It's Norway, and it starred Stellan Skarsgård.
Correct.
Oof, he's back in the game.
So it's even Stevens now, boys. Matt, what's the name of the spaceship in Interstellar? Is it Perseverance, Endurance, or Longevity?
I know this one as well. Endurance.
Correct. Of course you do. All right, Jamie. Mr. Ali is a character from which Nolan film? Memento, The Prestige, or Insomnia?
Definitely not Memento, because that's probably the Nolan film I know best. I've seen it many times. It's not that. The other two, Prestige, and what was the other one you said, sorry?
So it's Memento, The Prestige, or Insomnia?
I think it's Prestige, just judging from the name. It sounds more prestige-y.
It is, and he was played by Andy Serkis, so there we go.
Oh, okay.
Point for you. Well done. Okay, Matt. In 2015, Nolan directed a documentary about the filmmakers, the Quay brothers, or the Brothers Quay. What are the brothers' first names? Robert and Michael, Thomas and Jonathan, Stephen and Timothy.
This is the only Nolan film I haven't seen. And, this is going to have to be a guess for me, sadly. Did you know it, Jamie? Do you know the answer?
No.
I just wondered if you knew the answer.
No.
I'm not familiar with the Quay Brothers films either. So I'm just going to go for that last one just because I like the name Timothy. So I'm just going to guess it's Timothy and whatever the other one was.
Stephen and Timothy?
Yeah.
Correct.
Oh, yes.
So unfair that he's the Nolan expert and he spawns it when he doesn't know.
And this, Jamie, is your last option to equalise. Are you ready?
Go on. Yeah.
Which is Nolan's longest movie? Is it The Dark Knight, The Dark Knight Rises, or Interstellar?
I'm pretty sure that each of the three Batman films got longer as they went along. So Dark Knight Rises is longer than Dark Knight. Mm-hmm. So it's between that and Interstellar. Interstellar I really like. I think it's a terrific film and maybe a bit underrated in Nolan's canon. But I'm waffling. I would say it's probably Interstellar because I do remember it being really long, like 2 hours 45 or so. And I think it deserved that length. It, really good film, Interstellar.
Correct. Ooh. Even Stevens, it was 2 hours 49, Jamie. You
was
weirdo
it?
That you can remember that so specifically.
Well, I said 2:45.
Yeah, so very close. The Dark Knight is 2 hours 32. The Dark Knight Rises is 2 hours 44.
So all over 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
Do we know how long Tenet is yet? That's over 2.5, isn't it?
It surely must be.
I don't think it's been officially revealed yet. I don't think it's had its BBFC certificate yet.
Right.
But surely it is.
I think I read somewhere.
He doesn't go for a 90-minute, does he?
No, he doesn't. He gives bang for his buck that if you're going to pay £10 or £15 to go to a cinema, you're going to get 2.5 hours. High concept effect.
So now I need to draw with Jamie as well, at least when we do this PTA quiz as well.
Yes.
I have to start getting my research in.
The gauntlet has been thrown down there. But next week we will be ranking Christopher Nolan's films in the podcast. So find out which is the best of the best next week. But just here and now, what's your personal favourite, boys?
This is nigh on impossible for me because there's just so many kind of jockeying for that top spot. But if I was like backed into a corner right now, I'd have to just say the Dark Knight for how much it sort of means to me personally as well. You know, the time I saw it and all that kind of thing. But there's many that I think equally sort of deserving of the top spot.
For me, I go all the way back to his sophomore movie, Memento. I still think that, you know, it's very different to the stuff that's come since and that it's smaller, sort of more independent minded. But I think it's so fiendishly clever and moves at such a pace. You know, I really do love that film. Of his bigger, kind of more commercial tentpole movies, I may surprise people here and I may actually go Interstellar. I do really, really rate Interstellar.
How about you, Jane?
I would have to say Dunkirk. You know, I understand this sort of thing that people say that sometimes his films are so beautifully put together and lack some sort of real emotional clout. I can see that with some of them. But for me, Dunkirk was absolutely everything that's wonderful about Nolan and his sort of Swiss watch precision combined with that absolute emotional wallop that you got from what was going on there with the score and everything else. So yeah, Dunkirk's my favourite. With that in mind, please come back next week to find out what actually is the very best of the best when we do our ranking. But for now, we will say goodbye. But just to remind you that there is always 10% off a Total Film subscription when you use the code INSIDETF when you go to checkout at www.myfavouritemagazines.co.uk. So on that note, we'll say goodbye. Say goodbye,
bye.
Boy.
Bye, boys.
Bye.
Bye, boys.
Ha, ha, ooh, he, ha, ha, ha. And I thought my jokes were bad.